a training here this weekend to learn how to work more safely. Tell me a little bit about the training. Please, tell me your name.
My name is Maria.
Diana Francis, wilt thou have this man to thy wedded husband, to live together according to God's law?
Elizabeth Alexandra Mary, wilt thou...
Aye, Tamara.
Aye, Tamara.
Want to thank...
Catherine Elizabeth. Catherine Elizabeth, wilt thou have this man to thy wedded husband, to live together according to God's law in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love him, comfort him, honor and keep him in sickness and in health, and forsaking all...
Now, let's get back to Just Love. The Catholic Channel SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Thank you for being with us on our weekly conversation about what's going on in the world through the prism of our Catholic social wisdom. You can check out my blog at justloveblog.com. Follow me on Twitter at MSGRKSullivan to learn more about the topics that we talk about on Just Love. I am excited about our show today. We're going to begin by talking about a topic which is very, very serious and, you know, maybe not all that uplifting, but we're going to speak about mental health issues with Dr. Aaron Chiarotti, who is an associate professor of psychiatry at UC Irvine. And I'm very, very pleased that he is making the time to be with us on Just Love as we're raising up mental health awareness during this month of May. And so I'm delighted that he is with us. And then I am excited because a little bit later on in the show, we're going to have a little fun. We're going to talk about the royal wedding that is in England. And I think it's just we're going to have a delightful time. And we're going to have as our guest somebody who is my chief of staff and the corporate secretary of Catholic Charities, Marion Botejou, who has incredibly impeccable credentials in so many different areas. She was actually born in the country that we broke away from, England, and when we won that Revolutionary War. And she also grew up in the last Commonwealth nation of the British Empire when the sun no longer set, when the sun did then set on the British Empire. So I'm delighted that she's here as our expert on all things British and all things royal wedding, and we're going to talk about that. And I'm delighted that we have in our studio today also Fanny Gomez, who works with us in social media at Catholic Charities, who's kind of going to be with us in the studio here with regard to our news notes. And again, I want to thank Tom Dobbins, who is here with us for kind of lining up our guests for us this week. And I'm delighted that I think we have a good crew here. And I think our show is going to be very interesting. And, you know, listeners, I'm interested in the show. I hope you are going to be interested in it. And I'm glad that Scott's here with us, who kind of going to bring a few clips of weddings, which will kind of focus us on the importance of what's going on in England. Or as my guest from a couple of weeks ago gave me a great phrase. So I'm going to credit Julie Mason with the great phrase she gave us about things can be both useless and important at the same time. So I'm crediting Julie with that great insight into all parts of life as we kind of have our show this week. So listen, let me go to our first guest and to speak about a topic that is very, very serious and is something that impacts so many individuals and so many families throughout the United States, mental illness. And so I'm delighted that, let me welcome to the show Dr. Aaron Cariatri, who is an associate professor of psychiatry at UC Irvine. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Cariatri. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Monsignor.
Good, and thanks for taking the time. So so this is Mental Health Awareness Month, and you know what I've been saying to everybody a little bit is that the responsibility that I think we have as kind of faith people is to recognize and to help people to understand that mental health is not a sin. It's not kind of a moral failing, but it's something that, you know, is an illness. And it's like we're kind of comfortable with physical illness, but mental illness we kind of put in a different category. From your experience, is there a way that you kind of talk about that with people so that we can, you know, maybe raise awareness of the reality of mental illness and take away some of the stigma that prevents people from getting help with regard to it?
Yeah, so thank you for that question, and I agree. This distinction between sickness and sin is a very important one for us to draw, because when we're talking about a mental illness, when we're talking about someone suffering from severe clinical depression or bipolar disorder, what used to be called manic depression, or schizophrenia, or crippling anxiety that's impairing their ability to function, we're not talking about a moral weakness or a character defect. My friend, evangelical pastor Rick Warren out here in California, who very tragically lost his son Matthew a few years ago to mental illness. His son took his own life after struggling for years with a severe mental illness. Rick likes to say that your chemistry is not your character and your illness is not your identity. And actually the bishops of California, Catholic bishops of California, cited him in that very phrase in their recent pastoral letter on caring for people with mental illness and supporting their families. So it is, on the one hand, it's important to recognize that mental illness does impact all aspects of people's lives, including their spiritual life, including their ability to maybe sense or feel God's presence in their life. So it does influence them spiritually. There's no doubt about that. But to reduce all mental illness to just a spiritual problem, or to sort of prematurely spiritualize it and begin to think, well, gee, I wouldn't be suffering from this depression, or I wouldn't be struggling with this anxiety if only I prayed more or went to Mass more often or read the Bible more frequently. And so blaming oneself for something that may be not entirely within one's own control, I think that doesn't help the person who's suffering. When other people make those kinds of assumptions, they're unwarranted. They're really unjust and unfair, and represent a kind of misunderstanding of the nature of what mental illness is, what things contribute to and cause mental illness. And so I think it's important right now for Catholics, and indeed all people of goodwill, to begin to gain a better understanding of the nature of mental illness and to work to overcome these sorts of unjust ways of stigmatizing it that unfortunately still seem to be fairly pervasive in our society.
So let me go to the next point, which again I think is something which, you know, is probably too prevalent in the culture. I'm not sure how prevalent, but any of it is not good. I mean, I live in New York, Manhattan Island, and, you know, we kind of do a little bit of a joke saying there are probably more psychiatrists per square inch than there are streetlights and potholes here, because there seems to be high concentration. But, you know, the stereotype of kind of psychiatry and psychology is it doesn't do any good. Everybody talks to everybody and it just keeps going. They go on for years and years, but nobody ever gets any better. And That's not true, is it?
No, that's not true. And in fact, we have developed in contemporary medicine and modern psychiatry some very helpful treatments for many, if not most, mental illnesses. Some of those treatments are talk therapy, psychotherapy based. Some of them are medication based. Some of them are novel procedures that can be helpful for people struggling with mental illness in correcting or modifying some of the underlying biological factors that contribute to mental illness. There are other factors, psychological, social, and sometimes even spiritual factors that can influence the development of a mental illness. But we can't forget that we're creatures of flesh and blood, and that our genetics and our brain chemistry are there and can't be ignored. And so the old stereotype, which is really based on early 20th century psychoanalysis, which was Sigmund Freud and his disciples and their particular form of talk therapy, that, you know, 5 days a week lying on the couch, free associating and going on for years and years, you know, trying to contend with or deal with minor neuroses, that is not really an accurate picture of contemporary psychiatry and contemporary psychology. So I think people need to overcome some of those cultural and historical stereotypes and really come to a better understanding of what it looks like to receive treatment these days from someone in the mental health field.
Is there a particular way that, you know, we should be talking about those things so we overcome that particular stereotype? So what, you know, again, and this is an unfair question. If the old image, which we have in our head, is, you know, somebody laying on a couch 5 days a week, free associating, what new images should we kind of get in our head that would give us a more accurate idea of what's going on in psychotherapy and counseling these days that would give people a greater maybe comfort with that it is something that we should be, you know, promoting where appropriate?
Sure. Yeah, so great question. And psychotherapy, there is not just one particular method or one particular approach. So maybe I'll just cite one example.
That'd be great.
That can illustrate, because there's different approaches and different forms of psychotherapy that can be helpful for different kinds of disorders. And to sort of try to run through all of them would take us very far afield.
Right.
But one contemporary approach that's known as cognitive therapy is basically more or less about bringing our thoughts into better alignment with reality. And that should be something that all Catholics and indeed every rational, sane human person can embrace.
Doctor, let me interrupt you for a moment.
Yeah.
Given what's going on in the world that we're in, I'm not sure I want to be in touch with that reality too much. So.
Well, there is that.
But I guess
my reality is what I mean by that is not all the nonsense and craziness that's going on in contemporary society, but in fact, taking us away from that and grounding our thinking in actual truths about ourselves and about the world and about the future and about human nature. So point very well taken. But one of the things that cognitive therapy recognizes is that people usually present for problems on the emotional level or on the behavioral level. You know, I keep doing this compulsive thing that I can't stop, even though I'm trying to stop. Or I'm feeling overwhelmed by panic attacks or by profound depression. And many psychotherapies aim to directly alter our behavior or our emotional state, whereas cognitive therapy moves upstream and says, okay, one of the key things influencing those behaviors or influencing that particular emotional state that you're struggling with is the habitual pattern of thinking that you've developed. And so to begin to unpack what are some of the automatic thoughts that occur just before you develop those anxiety symptoms, or as that panic attack is building, before it becomes incapacitating, can we get a handle on what's running through your mind and learn to interrupt a process that's sort of spinning out of control in order to better align your thinking with the realities of your life or
Can you give us I'm not asking you to violate any confidentiality at all, but can you give me a concrete example of somebody that our listeners could relate to, like a particular either obsession or thing, and how you might interrupt it?
Sure. So I supervise medical students on their psychiatry rotation, and I think other people who have been in school might relate to something like this. So a student who's under a lot of stress because medical school is difficult, and maybe they're having particular struggle with psychiatry as opposed to their other rotations because psychiatry seems different, or they just can't get a handle on it. The disorders are sort of abstract and unusual. And so they start worrying, maybe I'm going to fail the exam at the end of the psychiatry clerkship, and if I fail the exam, then I'm going to fail the course, and if I fail the course, I'm going to fail out of medical school, and suddenly they're spinning, thinking, you know, I'm going to be $200,000 in debt, and my life is going to be in shambles. And cognitive therapy is not just about taking a sort of train of negative thinking and replacing it with positive thinking. If the person doesn't actually believe the more positive thoughts, that's not going to work. It's about saying, okay, maybe it's true. Maybe you are going to fail the exam at the end of the course. But before you let that thought run your life, let's sit down and gather some evidence. What evidence do you have to believe that that thought is true based on your prior experience, based upon your current experience? What evidence do you have to believe that maybe it's not true? And the cognitive therapist will run through a very structured process of gathering evidence, helping the person to sort of analyze it, reframe their thinking, dial it down if it's exaggerated or distorted in some way, and help the person begin to recognize when those thoughts are sort of running like an automatic sort of tape recorder in the back of their head when they maybe even didn't realize how frequently they're having these kind of catastrophic thoughts that lead to stress or anxiety or what have you. So that's sort of one approach among many that could be taken by a psychotherapist, who in that case is sort of coaching the person along through a structured process to get a handle on what's going on in their inner experience, or in this case specifically in their thinking in regards to the future, and over time sort of teaching the person a new skill that they can develop and use on their own. And one of the interesting things about that form of therapy is that it works, it's been shown to work equally well for depression as medications for depression. But when you stop medications, the effect tends to wear off in terms of preventing future episodes of depression or continuing to get improvement in one's symptoms. But when you stop cognitive therapy, the benefits continue to persist after you've discontinued, and that's because you're actually teaching the person new skills, new ways of thinking and perceiving and sort of managing difficult aspects of their life.
We're speaking with Dr. Aaron Cariatri, who is an associate professor of psychiatry at UC Irvine, and we're delighted that this is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we're kind of raising up this as an issue which there should be not stigma attached to, but hope, and that there should be people engaging in treatment that can be successful. So, Dr. Cariatri, let me ask you a question which may be a little bit bordering on blaming the victim, and I don't mean to do that or that it's the person's sure fault, but it does seem to me that sometimes there's real resistance for people who could get who maybe could be helped by some type of counseling or some type of treatment, there may be a little bit of a resistance in them seeking that treatment. So let me ask it this way. What role does kind of personal responsibility play in somebody deciding, well, I'm not going to get treatment, or them deciding to get treatment?
Absolutely. I think there's a central role for personal responsibility in recovering from a mental health problem. And certainly with behavioral disorders, if you're talking about an addiction or an eating disorder, all the medication or psychotherapy in the world is not going to do an ounce of good if the person doesn't first have the willingness and the humility to recognize that they have a problem, that they need help for that problem, and they need to put in some serious effort to work on overcoming that problem. So a patient who's receiving mental health care is not just the passive recipient of the therapies and the ministrations of other people. That, in most cases, does not work. And so there is a role for humility and self-knowledge. There is a role for overcoming resistance based upon shame or based perhaps upon upon pride in the sense that I can sort of manage or handle this thing on my own and I don't need assistance from anyone else. And so while we shouldn't blame people for problems that have a biological origin or for problems that may be outside of their control because they experienced trauma or, you know, early childhood problems like abuse and neglect that were clearly outside of their control, we can at the same time recognize that that person does have some degree of responsibility for engaging in the process of getting help and of recovery and of making improvement and working to overcome those problems. So it's not an either or in this case. It's sort of a both and. On the one hand, you know, we need to recognize that we shouldn't blame the victim. On the other hand, we need to recognize that the person who's afflicted does have does bear some degree of responsibility for working to overcome the problem and to accept the fact that they may need help from people outside.
Hey, Dr. Cariatri, you've been so generous with your time. And from my perspective, you just were able to kind of take some very, very important ideas surrounding mental illness, mental health, awareness, treatment, and to really kind of lay them out in a way that I think you really have upped my understanding, my awareness, and I really believe of our listeners. So thanks so much for being with us on Just Love, and thank you for the work you're doing, and thank you for dealing with a very difficult but such an important area of kind of human dignity and increasing respect for our humanity. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Monsignor. It's great to be with you.
Good. Thank you. So this is Mental Health Awareness Month. Cardinal Dolan visited one of those Catholic Charities agencies a week or so ago that specializes in trying to help children, basically children from the age of 4 to 14, to deal with their mental illnesses and to live their lives in ways in which they can function much better in society with their families, to grow, to succeed in school. So I'm delighted that we were able to have Dr. Cariatri on our show and to kind of raise up awareness. Let's take a break, and we'll be back in just a few moments on Just Love. Just Do It. God, neighbor, self, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join me when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Now, let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I am Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Hey, Fatty, so what'd you think about our first guest? What'd you think about Dr. Cariatri?
I thought he was great. I mean, obviously, he's very knowledgeable. He knows what he's talking about. But the few things that he said that kind of hit home because, you know, in my family, there is mental health. There's addiction to alcohol, et cetera. And we can't get help for anyone if they don't admit it for themselves. There's, like he said, there's a sense of pride. Like, I don't need the help. I can do this on my own. So that hit home because it's very true. You can't help someone who doesn't want to be helped, you know?
Yeah. So I thought he was very good. So thanks. You know, let's now go. Last weekend, I was at the closing of a session in which a number of our day laborers received safety training for about 40 hours. And so I'd like you to listen to a little bit how a couple of those day laborers took to that training.
So you went through a training here this weekend to learn how to work more safely. Tell me a little bit about the training.
Yeah, well, we were here for 5 days, basically, the whole day, 5 days. And we received trainings through, it was a very dynamic training, through a lot of experiences. Some were physical, some were listening to a class, some were doing our own projects. And we definitely learned a lot. I especially learned a lot about where to find the information that I needed to be safer. Like the OSHA webpages for government and other companies that can help us, like insurance companies that can help us assess security. I think I learned also about the rights that we have as employees. That's very important because there's some things that you have a sense of, but you don't know that they're actual laws and then they're there to protect you.
Can you tell me one thing you learned that you didn't know before you came here?
Well, I knew that the employers had to keep us safe, but I didn't know to which degree. Now I know that definitely they have to provide the 3 different levels of solutions to keep us safe, right? Administration, engineering, and PPE, or protection, or equipment. And another, but something I had never thought about is about mental health in the job. That's also an employer has to give us an environment where it's safe, emotionally, mentally, and not only physical.
So you invested a lot of time in coming to this. Would you recommend that other laborers take this safety training?
Absolutely, because yes, we did spend a lot of time here, but I think we received a lot more than the time that we gave back. And not only did we get the training, but we got the food, excellent food, a lot of food so we didn't have to spend that money from our own pockets those days that we're here. We also got a stipend for our time. That is, to me, it's crazy. I am really appreciative of that. I really appreciate that because
So that was just a wonderful testimony to what was there. And it was true that 90% or more of the workers there were men, like the day laborer I just interviewed. But there were a few women there, and I'm delighted that we were able to hear the experience of Maria in that training she received.
Please, tell me your name.
My name is Maria Isabel Carrasquillo, and I'm 36 years old.
And tell me a little bit about the training you went through these past weeks.
Well, I can tell you that I'm amazed about, you know, I could never imagine that I would be going through this if it wasn't because first I saw the 10-hour training, and then thanks to Mr. Gerardo, I'm here in the 30-hour training, and I can tell you that this is a wealth of information that every worker should have, you know, to just be safe in any type of job, and any type of job site, any type of job that you are doing.
Can you tell me one thing you learned that you didn't know before?
Well, what I didn't know is that now, you know, the standards that the worker is held to, you know, the standards of safety, at least I didn't know any of it before coming. Even for the tenant, I did not know any of it. And now that I have this information, I can actually go out and, you know, share and tell people what you should be doing, what you should be doing for yourself, for others. So I learned a lot.
Is there one specific thing that you learned that you didn't know that you find to be very helpful?
And the specific thing is that, you know, when, as a woman, you know, as a mother, and when you're handling chemicals, like just the household, you know, simple chemicals, and what can they do to your body, to your system, to your children. So that's one thing that, you know, surprised me, that the effect of chemicals on your body or in the bodies. So that's one of the things that surprised me the most.
So you may think of Catholic Charities as providing food, pantries, homeless shelters, and we do a lot of that. But part of our mission is to encourage the dignity of work, make sure people work safely. So we sponsored this OSHA safety training for our day laborers. Now, that's really positive, to help those day laborers to make sure their safety. But, you know, the news isn't always positive about what's going on in our country with immigrants. Fanny, there's some recent stuff going on which isn't so positive with regard to immigrants, is it?
Yeah, so a discharge petition was filed on May 9th. It's intended to force votes on a series of immigration measures, including legislation to protect Dreamers and families from being separated. So filing of the petition is an attempt to go around leadership to force a vote on the floor. The discharge petition would specifically force a vote on Queen of the Hill, a rule that would lead to votes on a series of competing immigration proposals, whichever measure won the most votes would be the legislation approved by the House. So far, 19 Republicans have signed, and they need 25 total.
Okay. So part of what Fannie's talking about is that there was a promise that there was going to be some solution for the minors who were brought here by their parents when they were just young people, children, and that there would be some resolution for their situation. Nothing has happened. There's been that paralysis in Washington, and nothing has happened there. And the other news, which is not part of that particular attempt to get some legislation in Washington, is the Department of Homeland Security has announced their intent to separate women, mothers from their children, and to possibly even house the children in military bases near the border of the United States and Mexico. So there's some really not some good news on the immigration front, where we have to stand up for the dignity of the human person. And we, the Catholic Church, has been pretty clear in two things. One, we have to respect immigrants. We need a fair and humane policy. We need a way for those who are here without the proper documents to earn a way out of the shadows. And our position is also we do need secure borders, that we're not in favor of illegal immigration. And in this day and age, you just can't get a good conversation about those topics. So we kind of need to hope and pray for that. So let's take a break. Fanny, I want to tell me, how did you get asked to your prom?
It was just a simple, it wasn't anything dramatic, anything that went viral or anything. It was a simple conversation. Him and I were in, I think, English class, and he said that he didn't have a date. I didn't have a date, so we just decided to go together.
Okay, well, that's good. But don't we have an interesting prom proposal that's kind of made the rounds these days?
Yeah, so we have, they're calling it a promposal. So Kiona Moore asked Tywin Malik Barber to prom. So Tywin is a special needs student in Washington, D.C., and she is the head cheerleader at that high school. And she walked into the cafeteria with a huge prom poster with balloons and cupcakes and things like that, and asked him to prom. And, you know, she said that regarding this, she said, I felt like I should just like I should just make someone happy for once and not just do it for attention, but actually do a good deed and actually care, show care and love. So this thing went viral. They, you know, recorded it. She put it on Facebook and Twitter and went viral. And now she's famous, this girl. And his mom, Tywin's mom, actually said that she cried when she saw the video because, you know, he's in a wheelchair. He's special needs. She probably didn't even think he would be asked to prom, and now he has a date.
And probably she would not have had a big problem getting a date to the
right.
prom.
Right. No, probably. Well, she's the head cheerleader, so I'm sure she's, you know, she's been asked.
By the quarterback, you think?
Right, maybe.
If that isn't stereotypical, isn't it? Listen, let's take a break, and we'll be back in just a minute. Hey, if you want to know more about what we're talking about here on Just Love, you can check out my blog, justloveblog.com, and remember to follow me on Twitter at MSGRK Sullivan. We'll be back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Just do it. Just love. Just check out Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's here right now. Take it away, Monsignor.
I will take it away. I'm here. I'm delighted that having the studio, Fanny Gomez here, and we thank Tom Dobbins for getting us our very good first guest. And so the royal wedding, the royal weekend, you know, it's this weekend. It's like now. It's here. So... but this isn't the only royal wedding ever. Let's go back about 7 years and let's listen to the exchange of vows with the wedding between William and Kate.
Catherine Elizabeth, wilt thou have this man to thy wedded husband, to live together according to God's law in the holiest state of matrimony? Wilt thou love him, comfort him, honor and keep him in sickness and in health? And forsaking all other, keep thee only unto him, so long as ye both shall live.
I will.
Well, that was the wedding 7 years ago,
And I'm delighted we have in the guest as our guest today, Marion Botejo, who is the corporate secretary of Catholic Charities and my chief of staff. Are you over it?
Over what?
Are you over it? I mean, this you know, that, you know, William didn't ask you.
You know, these things take time, and I think, you know, maybe in another year or so I'll feel a little bit better about it. But the children are cute. You know, it's a little difficult to.
But they could have been yours.
Well, they would have been cuter if they were mine.
Okay, but, all right. Know, but, well,
we take what we can get.
Yeah, but, well, I'm glad that you are willing to kind of come out of your doldrums and to kind of be with us as our wedding expert. So, and by the way, just so that our listeners know, Marion is still part of that country that we beat. In the Revolutionary War, she was born in London, and she grew up for part of her young life in Sri Lanka, as I mentioned before, which is the last of the Commonwealth countries to break away. And so she's our expert. So come on, give us a little bit of a preview or a post view or a something view of this wedding.
Well, I mean, it's certainly taking the headlines by storm, but I think most British royal weddings do, particularly as it relates to the royal family, the immediate royal family, right? So when Kate and William got married, it was a very big deal. Harry's life, right, as a royal has been followed, his exploits, being the youngest grandson of Queen Elizabeth, his tirades through American and European hotels, sans clothes, has gotten a lot of coverage. So I think everyone's really excited to see him settle down. So the wedding's at 12 noon.
So I want to know. So tell me this.
Oh,
so No.
Maybe I shouldn't have thrown
No, that's good. So seriously.
He's a bit of a playboy. So
well,
this is
but.
A calming effect on
him. I would just want everybody to know, Fanny, that we're on American Sirius Radio because you would have been put in the Tower of London if you made those remarks in the motherland, right?
I mean, so following the tradition of how Catholics were treated in the UK, I'd be happy in the Tower of London.
Well, that's true. So, but they've gotten a little more civil, haven't these weddings gotten a little more civil? Because I mean, sadly, there was the divorce between Honorary Princess Diana and Charles, and sadly there is a divorce because we're never happy when there is a divorce, but thank God she didn't lose her head.
That's
your tradition, right? Going back to Henry VIII. I mean, I just watched The Tudors, and I mean,
it's a great show.
Yeah, it is. But so was there.
There is a bit of a precedent for women not faring so well in royal marriages. However, Diana did give the crown. Two beautiful sons, and so maybe that's why she got to keep her head.
Oh, that's true. And actually, probably if Catherine had, she would have still remained queen. And actually, maybe
right, we would have had maybe a very different story,
and we wouldn't have had two churches.
Well, you know, and actually, I just learned this a couple of days ago. I was doing some research since I was going to be the UK attaché for the wedding and Just Love. That Henry, correct me if I'm wrong here, Monsieur, but Henry VIII, he actually never left. He never converted formally to become a Protestant. So he remained a Catholic, even though he was the head of the Church of England. Yeah. He never denounced his Catholic faith, which I thought was really interesting. You know,
So since you asked the question, let me do a little bit of history here. Okay, so this is all the time of what has come to be called the Protestant Reformation. And basically, there were some doctrinal issues that Luther had against the Roman Church. And some of them were also some political corruption issues that were there and things that weren't there. And Luther clearly, you know, had those things. But Luther himself didn't think he was leaving the Catholic Church. They threw him out because he thought he didn't want to get thrown out, but it was clear he wasn't. England, on the other hand, didn't have any problems with any of the doctrine of the church. And as they talk about, you know, Henry VIII probably had ghosted for him by Thomas More, mm-hmm. a book in which he got the title Defender of the Faith on it. And so, no, he didn't think that he was leaving the Catholic Church. He was just deciding that he was going to decide the rules, not the doctrine.
And so...
In the later part of his career, there was the big fight between those parts of the Church of England that wanted to stay quote unquote more Roman Catholic, mm-hmm. and those who wanted to stay more reformist. So you're absolutely right on that.
And another thing, it's
but that's too serious. We want to know about
we
want to know about this important but useless but important, you know, royal wedding.
So we have an American marrying into the royal family that's actually in line to the throne. Number six, Harry now.
He's number six?
He's number six.
Okay.
He got bumped. And I just like to give a lot of, you know, credit and high applause to Charlotte, who has changed the rules and now the first female royal and, you know, direct line to the throne. So we, you know.
Well, wait a minute. Hold on for a second. We did have Elizabeth. So what'd they do? They connive to get around the rules?
A little bit. So Elizabeth, there were two children, right, born into the royal family at that time. So when her father got stuck with the job,
right,
it was just her and her sister, you know. So there was really no other option there. But so yes, now Harry, number six in line to the throne, getting married to Meghan Markle, who I, you know, learned her real name is Rebecca. Right?
No,
is that, no?
Rachel.
Is that Rachel? Oh, sorry. Rachel. Excuse me, Rachel.
Come on, you're losing your status.
I am the attaché for the UK, not the America,
right.
So
okay.
I can slide on that. So the wedding's at 12 EST, so get up early if you're in the States. And it's taking place at St. George's, so a little bit of a different venue from William and Catherine, a smaller church on the grounds of Windsor Castle. Smaller guest list, about 600 people, whereas William and Catherine had about 1,200.
Just a small, intimate gathering,
right,
of
exactly,
friends.
Right, exactly, of 600. There are screens outside for all fans of America and the UK coming together, finally, in some type of gesture. You can watch it live.
So permit me to be just, again, a little bit serious for a moment, and I am absolutely enthralled by this. I mean, I really am. Kind of take the only thing I'm more obsessed by are Beyonce concert than these royal weddings, because I think they I do like the idea of useless but important but useless, but I want to focus on the important part, because we do live in a world in which a lot of tradition and the most important thing has happened in the past 45 seconds on Twitter. And in a serious sense, doesn't this bring us back to that there are some maybe standards, there are some ways that we interact with each other which have stood the test of time, and maybe we shouldn't throw them out so readily?
Yeah, I mean, Mid-Senior, you and I work together, so you know how I feel about this, but I mean, I definitely think that tradition, right, is in short supply, not just here in the States, but I think just generationally, right? So the value of tradition, and never mind tradition, I think the value of civility, right? And just behaving in a civilized manner, having, you know, a sense of decorum. These are things that are not valued culturally across the world, not just in the States. So I think the royal family and a kind of royal protocol, that people find it fascinating, because I think it does uphold what is supposed to be traditional values. And so while, you know, what was the phrase you used? Something but useless,
important.
Useless, but right. I think people are fascinated because, as Winston Churchill had said, you know, in the time of the Queen Elizabeth getting married, you know, people need something to aspire to. This is going to sound terrible, but like those of us who are commoners or kind of outside the walls, you know, need something to aspire to and some sense of joy, particularly at that time. And you think about the royal wedding of Queen Elizabeth to Prince Philip. It was a very, you know, different time in history in terms of the war and the different situation that the British people, the public, and the world were involved with and kind of encumbered
by. Do we have the clip of her wedding? All right,
let's listen to that. But so I think it just has a way of lifting people up and distracting you, right?
Right.
From like the humdrum, all the chaos of your day, to something that we can be.
Let's listen to the exchange of vows with Queen Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, Alexandra, Mary, wilt thou have this man to thy wedded husband, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou obey him and serve him, love, honor, and keep him in sickness and in health, and forsaking all other, Keep thee only unto him, so long as ye both shall live.
So, ma'am, so Marion, what is this obey and serve stuff?
Right.
And he's got to now genuflect to the queen who she's got to obey and serve. So sort this one out for us.
So that this is a bit of a controversy back then, I think, for the royal cohort, right? The royal cohort, because Queen Elizabeth actually wanted to keep the word obey when she was exchanging her marital vows, and the royal cohort were a little nervous about that because the queen shouldn't be obeying anyone. And I think this says a lot about, you know, this woman, Queen Elizabeth, who's will be celebrating 71 years of marriage this year in November to Prince Philip.
And how long she been queen?
Oh gosh, so sorry, this is terrible. Maybe about 74 years?
Enough is enough. Come on.
No, we want to keep her.
No, come on. Charles.
I'm going to ask someone to Google that and let me know the answers.
Charles needs a chance. Come on.
Well, that's a whole different show.
Hold on for a second. You just got the thing for William.
Yeah,
you want them to bypass Charles so that your guy can get the job.
Right. It's my. I'm putting my money on William. But I think, so Queen Elizabeth is real kind of she's upheld tradition. Not just for the UK, but I think globally, right? She's this woman who became queen at a very young age and has carried the office with a lot, with a dignity and grace. And so I think the fact that she, in her marital vows, chose to go traditional, it says a lot about her as a person, right? And her ability to separate her office.
Yeah, but
as
that was
the queen.
But that was back in the 50s.
Yeah. Okay, so we talked about tradition and civility, and I mean, this is a wedding, right? So this is about marriage, and certainly today marriage has taken a lot of different inflections and tones across the world. The importance of marriage, the value of marriage, how tradition plays into that.
So let me talk a little bit about another issue, because one of the things that's a little different about this and is that Meghan Markle is divorced. And for a while, and there is a history when one of those guys over there, I forget who, Edward or somebody, when he wanted to marry somebody who was divorced, I think they made him give up the throne, didn't they? They made him not abdicate.
Oh, yes, he abdicated.
Because
he wanted to marry the thrice divorced woman from New York,
all right,
French woman.
You know, once divorced, twice divorced. So anyway, so now there's a little bit more openness because the queen still has to give her consent to this. And by the way, I mind you, that she didn't call her dearly beloved like she did Kate, because we beat you guys in the Revolutionary War. She only says beloved and noble.
We're happy. If you'd like to come back with your current situation, maybe we can talk about your current political situation.
Yeah, well, you're pulling away from the whole world with Brexit and all that. But the changing kind of norms, and again, as we say, that you know, our belief is that marriage should be forever, but we also recognize that sometimes things don't work out. And so, you know, I do think it is in light of that, that there's been a little bit of controversy in the Catholic Church about the recent teaching of Pope Francis, which he reaffirmed when the Brazilian bishop said this. And here's what the current teaching is. And I know there's been a lot of stuff on both sides. So let me give you the extremes of this. And the extremes of this is that now Pope Francis says it doesn't matter if you're divorced and remarried, you can go to communion and everybody go to communion and no questions asked. Then the other extreme says, oh, nothing has ever changed. So even if you're divorced and remarried, you can never, ever go to communion. Well, both of those are false, and I will defend that to anybody. What Pope Francis has put forth and reaffirmed a number of times is that, wait a minute, things like this happen, there are divorces, and that in a case-by-case basis, an individual couple should kind of discern their current status and determine in consultation and with prayer and with thought whether or not in their situation they might go to communion. And that is the clear teaching that he has put forth in Moris Laetitia, reaffirmed when the Brazilian bishops said, here's how we would like this to be implemented. And he said very clearly, yep, that's the correct and full understanding of it. So let's dispel the fact that there's controversy over what he said. He didn't say everybody go to communion whenever you want. And he didn't say you can never go to communion in that. It's very balanced. It's very prayerful. It's very discerning. And that's what the reality is. So anyway, which gives us a chance to reflect upon that in light of this wedding day. I do want to kind of come to the end of our segment by contrasting this. Okay. Why we just heard those wonderful exchange of vows. Let's listen to the other extreme of an American wedding.
Hi, Tamara.
Hi, Tamara.
Want to thank you, Darren.
Want to thank you, Darren.
I appreciate you.
I appreciate you.
I value you.
I value you.
And I adore you.
I adore you.
I will never take you for granted.
I will never take you for granted.
Or be ungrateful.
Or be ungrateful.
For I know what you have done.
For I know what you've done.
For me and our family.
For me and my family. Our family.
It is nothing short of a miracle.
Nothing short of a miracle.
I loved you before.
I loved you before.
I love you now.
I love you now.
And I will love you in our future.
And I'll love you in our future.
In front of all these screwed up crazy.
Screwed up crazy.
Wannabe redneck people.
Wannabe redneck people.
We call our friends and family.
We call our friends and family.
I reaffirm my love for you.
I reaffirm my love for you.
Yeah, I should probably swap spit now.
They say swap spit. Swap spit. Then Senior Solomon, anytime you want to come back to the British Empire, you are, you know, we will consider
I want to borrow the voices of those Anglican priests.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
I could never even do that. Do you take? I mean, it is the most wonderful, pretentious language.
It's the real English.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We might want to point out that Marion never can figure out how to get up and down buildings because she asks, well, where the lift is, and they send her to the parking lot to get on the thing that takes the cars up and down. It's the elevator, Marion. It's the elevator.
I appreciate all of you putting up with me. So much grace.
Hey, Fanny, you've been to a raunchy wedding?
Not that raunchy.
Okay.
But, I mean, not really an American raunchy wedding, but I... You know, my town in the Dominican Republic where I'm from, it's very humble. So you know, I've been to weddings that they're completely outside and you're sweating the whole time. And there's like flies on the food. Like,
Brides don't sweat. They glow.
No,
they
glitter.
Glisten. They glisten. They glisten. So anyway, I thank you for being with us on Just Love. And I would really ask a couple of things. One, this issue of mental health, mental illness is really plagues about probably 20% of the population in the United States in various forms. So let's try to reduce the stigma. Let's try to make people realize that there's treatment. People can get help from this and encourage people to seek that treatment. If we do that as Catholics throughout the country and others, I think we make a major step forward in kind of making our world a better place. And also, as we've had a little fun talking about the British wedding, let's realize that marriage is critically important. The sacredness of marriage is important, and we need to support men and women who are in those marriages to help them to support one another and their children. Hey, thanks for being with us on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Join us each week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.